The Brand of Silence by Johnston Macaulay, writing as Harrington Strong. Chapter 23. A Startling Story. "This is a painful subject for me, as you must be aware," Kate Gilbert said. "I shall tell the story in as few words as possible, and if you are a gentleman, you will not interrupt or cause me more suffering by protesting your innocence."
"I promise not to interrupt," Sidney Prale replied. "I want justice and nothing more, Miss Gilbert."
10 years ago you were a clerk in the office of Griffin, the big broker, were you not?"
"Yes."
"Mr. Griffin took a fancy to you after your father died, and left you alone in the world without any money. He gave you odd jobs to do around his residence, fed and clothed you, and arranged it so that you could go to school. Your uncle, the father of George Lurton, your cousin, would do nothing for you, because there had been a family quarrel several years before. Had it not been for Mr. Griffin, you might have been an ordinary street Arab. He sent you to a business college after you had finished the public schools, and then he took you into his office and started you on a business career. You showed great promise, and Mr. Griffin was delighted and advanced you rapidly. You seemed to know the meaning of gratitude and worked hard. You were ambitious, too. Always said that some day you would be worth $1,000,000. Step by step, you went up the ladder. Then it happened that your cousin, George Lurton, obtained a position in the same office after his father's death. He had had the advantage of a college education, and knew how to handle himself in the presence of other men. And yet you, after your early struggle, and with an inferior education and inferior opportunities, easily outdistanced him. Other men began talking about you as a coming man, bankers and brokers, businessmen and financiers. Mr. Griffin finally gave you the post of chief clerk and adviser. You worked hard and seemed to be loyal and faithful. You got profits for your employer where other men would have caused losses, so he let you more and more into his confidence. You got to know the secrets of big deals, the inside facts of the country's finance. You spoke in millions, but got only a nice salary. Your ambition to be worth $1,000,000 seemed to be not susceptible of gratification. Yet you saved money and took advantage of small solid investments now and then. After a while you met a girl and fell in love with her. She was the sort who wished wealth above all, and you soon found that out. You became engaged to her, however. Then a rival appeared in the field, a wealthier man. You realized that the girl was shallow, in that she favored the man with more money. But you were so infatuated you overlooked that. You wanted the girl, and to get her, you had to have more money. Then you began to feel dissatisfied. You didn't want to grow gradually, as other men did. You wanted the foundation for a fortune, enough to use in a plunge on the market. You wanted to be rich as soon as possible. You began to think, perhaps, that you were not getting ahead. You worked in an atmosphere of wealth. You heard men speak in terms of millions, while you had less than $10,000 in the bank. You began to think that Mr. Griffin should do more for you, that he had not done enough. You forgot that he had picked you up and made you what you were, that you had so much more than other men who had not been equally fortunate in finding a sponsor. She ceased speaking for a moment, but Sidney Prale never took his eyes from her face. "Be ungrateful to Griffin? He never had dreamed of that. He always had worshipped Griffin for what the broker had done for him. He realized what he might have been only for Griffin." But he had promised not to interrupt, and so he said nothing, merely waited for Kate Gilbert to continue her recital. "You made certain plans," she went on. "Certain big business deals were in the wind, and as Mr. Griffin's confidential and chief clerk, you knew all about them. There were millions of dollars involved, the control of several large companies. And more than that, for Mr. Griffin and his associates were fighting a group of financial thieves who were trying to wreck excellent properties for the sake of making a gain. It was a fight for more than money. It was a fight to keep big business honest, to drive off the wolves and make finance solid. It was a tremendous thing. And you, a boy picked up and educated by a broker who had risen through his kindness, knew as much of the big deal contemplated as some of the wealthiest and most influential men of the country. There were men in the other group who would have given a million gladly to know what you, a clerk, knew. You were approached by one of that band of financial wolves. You were willing to listen. You wanted money, because the girl with whom you were infatuated demanded it before she would marry you. You believed that Griffin had not done enough for you, and you agreed to sell him out, him and his associates. Sidney Prale gasped, sat up straight in his chair, opened his mouth as if to speak, but did not when he saw the expression in her face. He decided to keep his word. "The agreement was made," she went on, "and you, who could have demanded $500,000 easily for the information you had, sold out your benefactor and his friends and the decent element on the street for a paltry 100,000. You sold your honor and your manhood for that." At this juncture, the woman in the case informed you that she wished to break the engagement because a man of money, your rival, had asked her to marry him, and she wanted his wealth. Instead of seeing what sort of woman she was, instead of coming to your senses then and stopping your deal with the other side, you took the opposite course. You would take the money, betray your benefactor and his friends, and leave the country. With that money as a foundation, you would build up a fortune. And that is what you did, Sidney Prale. You arranged everything nicely. You gave those men the information and received your 100,000, and then you quit your job and sailed away to Honduras. The battle began on the street, and because of the information you had sold them, the financial wolves got the better of the honest element. It was a battle that lasted for 2 weeks. The wolves meant every move, because they knew everything that had been planned. Fortunes were lost overnight. A score of big, decent men were ruined in their attempt to defeat the wolves and keep finance clean. Mr. Griffin, the man who had done everything for you, went down in the crash because you had sold him out. It was only 5 years ago that he got new backing and fought his way up again. Others went down with him, and some never regained their footing. Because of what you had done. Because you had played traitor. They knew there had been a leak, and there was an investigation. You had sailed away the day before the fight began. And that looked suspicious, because you had made up your mind suddenly. Finally, it was discovered that you were the traitor in the camp. My father was one of Mr. Griffin's associates, Mr. Prale. He lost his fortune, of course. We could have endured that, but the blow cost him his health. He was a giant of a man at that time, the best father in the world. You should see him now, Mr. Prale. See what your treason made of him. He is an invalid who sits all day in his wheelchair. At times his mind wanders and he fights that battle over again and calls curses down upon the head of the man who played traitor. My big, handsome, rich father is a broken, thin-faced man whose voice is a whisper and whose hands tremble because of what you did. You beast! She began sobbing softly as she glanced through the window, and Sidney Prale started to get out of his chair. but she faced him again quickly and motioned for him to remain silent.
"You wanted to hear it, and so I shall tell it all," she declared. "You had been clever. You had done this thing in such a manner that the law could not touch you. Yet you must have been afraid of it, for you fled the country. It was some time before things were adjusted, and then those men you had betrayed got together and determined to make you pay. They told the story to others, and they began gathering information about you. You were making your million all right, on the foundation that had wrecked a score of fortunes and lives, on treason instead of superior financial ability. And they swore that you should pay. They knew my father's story, of course, and knew that we had very little money. So they provided for him, and gave me funds, and sent me to Honduras to spy upon you. Marie, my maid since girlhood, who worshipped my father and knew all the circumstances, went with me. Soon after I reached Honduras, I found that you were selling out with the intention of returning to New York and enjoying your million. I communicated with the others and told them all I knew of your plans, whereupon they made some plans of their own. They won the sympathy of the most influential men in the city. They determined to make you pay. That is why the big trust company would not accept your account. A whisper in the ear of the hotel manager by the president of the company that owned the hotel, and you were as good as ordered out. Can you understand now, Mr. Prale? Coadley, the lawyer, was told that he will be made a nobody by the influential men of the town, unless he ceased to work for you, and he dropped your case. But there was to be no violence, and because they have descended to that, I have ceased to be interested in the affair. I know nothing about the Shepley murder case, or any trouble it may have caused you. That is quite another matter. Now that I have told my story, I hope that you are satisfied. It has shown you, I trust, that I know all, and that any falsehood you may utter will have no effect on me. I do not intend uttering a falsehood, Miss Gilbert, Sidney Prale assured her. What you have said has amazed and shocked me. So, that is why I was treated so badly upon returning to my home?
Exactly, she said.
Now, listen to me one moment, I beg of you. There is some mystery here, and though it is 10 years old, I shall solve it. Miss Gilbert, whether you believe me or not, I am not guilty of such treachery. I had no dealings with the financial wolves. When I left the United States, I took with me the $10,000 I had saved, nothing more, and I left nothing behind.
You made a million in 10 years with a capital of $10,000?
She asked with a slight sneer. I did, Miss Gilbert. I can prove every transaction, show you or anybody else exactly how I did it. Disbelieve me or not, it is the truth that I am innocent. If my people were sold out at that time, somebody else got the selling price. I was chagrined because my love affair had gone wrong. I shook the dust of New York from my feet. I did not even look at a New York newspaper for more than a year. Somebody else got the money, and I got a nasty name. Mr. Griffin, who was a father to me, thinks that I was an ungrateful cur. This thing is hard to believe, Mr. Gilbert, but I can never thank you enough for telling me. I am going to clear myself before I am done.
I cannot believe you, Mr. Prale. The proof was there.
And who furnished it? He demanded. Who is handling this campaign of vengeance against me now?
You scarcely can expect me to tell you that, she said. I am done. I have nothing more to do with the affair. But I am not going to be a traitor as you were.
If you ever are convinced, Miss Gilbert, that somebody has put this stain upon me for their own reasons, that I am entirely innocent, Can I count upon your friendship?
Convince me that injustice has been done you, Mr. Prale, and I'll do everything in my power to make amends, and so will all the others.
Thanks for that assurance, Prale said. I am going to clear myself in your eyes and in the eyes of the others. I remember the details of that big deal perfectly, and I shall know how to start to work.
I cannot understand this, she said. You speak as if you were indeed innocent, but I cannot believe it.
I am innocent.
If so, who is guilty?
That is what I intend finding out.
But you were in their confidence. You knew all the details of their financial plans, Kate Gilbert said. You were the only one who could have betrayed them. You scarcely expect me to believe that they betrayed themselves.
Any spying clerk in the Griffin offices could have told the enemy enough to betray the plans, Prale replied.
By the way, who is this man who goes too far and insists upon using violence? Who is the man who seems to be so extraordinarily vindictive toward me in this affair?
I can tell you nothing more, she declared. It would not be fair to them.
But they have Jim Farland, and heaven knows what they are doing to him, simply because he will not turn against me. Is it fair to Jim Farland's wife and child?
I am being kept informed, she assured him. If they treat Mr. Farland badly, or detain him much longer, I shall speak. But until then, I have nothing to say.
You see, Mr. Prale, I cannot believe that you are innocent and have been misjudged. The evidence against you is so conclusive.
And I have learned to hate you as the man who betrayed his benefactor and friends and wrecked my father's health.
But if you are innocent, I hope that you will forgive me.
I'll forgive you gladly, said Sidney Prale. I realize what you must have suffered, and what your father must have suffered too. I am going to prove my innocence, and then I hope to claim you as one of my friends.
I am sorry that I cannot believe you, she said again. Although I would like to, I would prefer to think that no man could be so ungrateful as to do such a thing. I'd like to have my faith in human nature restored. If you prove your innocence, I shall be very glad indeed. Then she called for Marie, and when the maid came from the adjoining room, Sidney Prale ushered the two women to the door and watched as they went down the hall toward the elevator. But Kate Gilbert did not glance back. End of Chapter 23.